How can we love exactly what's happening, or at least see the gift in whatever is happening, no matter how challenging it is, to not necessarily just label it as bad, but see it as providing some kind of opportunity. I ended up, you know, in arguments with people who didn't hold my views. And by being in argument, I really quickly noticed, it's like, I don't think I'm actually making headway. Like, I don't think I'm actually achieving what I'm hoping to achieve by trying to argue with people about these issues. And then when I actually began to see some more skillful people embodying empathy and actually connecting with people with different views, I saw the tremendous potency of actually bridging between people with different beliefs rather than trying to convince them. And so that's what really first inspired me into the work of conflict resolution and communication. It's a bit like having a poster on the wall for what do you do if there's a fire? Like, oh, go to this exit, pull this, you know, press this button, you know, etc. The same for conflict, that we know, okay, in this community, here are the resources available. Call this person, or, you know, we come together on Tuesday evenings to talk about tensions, or, you know, here's where the time of the month when we do some training, or, you know, like, how do we have a set of agreements? So that's something that I work with organizations on, is developing a system for responding to interpersonal tensions and conflicts, so that we really can have a well thought through and well supported strategy for dealing with those kinds of challenges. Conflict is a natural part of any relationship, and yet there are more, I would say, healthy or functional and more dysfunctional or damaging ways we can navigate conflict. And in fact, trying to avoid conflict, which happens a lot in some cultures or subcultures, or, you know, a lot of us do that because conflict has gone badly for us in our lives, so we tend to avoid it. But sadly, by avoiding it, it doesn't go away, it just goes underground, and then it comes bursting out the sides in even more destructive ways.
Welcome to episode 3 of this podcast, which I am tentatively calling All You Can Friend. This is Carl Stayart, and I'm excited for this conversation. Carl, we've been living in this house for a few weeks together, the Life Itself Hub. Would you be up for giving a little 3-minute elevator pitch to, like, what it is you're doing with your work and life?
Yeah, I'm not so, refined in my elevator pitches, but I'll see what I can do. What am I doing with my life and my work? I like the big question. A lot of what I'm passionate about, I think, relates to what you're doing with this podcast, in the sense that a big passion for me professionally and personally is about building community, and specifically communities that help support people's evolution or development, development in capacities for, like, personal well-being, but also how we can show up in the world in a way that contributes more to collective well-being, to the well-being of the communities and groups we're around, and to the wider world, to ecological and social issues. So in concrete terms, that kind of lofty aspiration looks like I've helped create and founded a number of intentional community houses. I've worked with EcoVillage and intentional community projects around the world. And I also have been developing and offering different kinds of educational transformational programs, usually for adults, although historically I've also worked with children and teens. And most specifically, what I'm working on now is developing a set of trainings for this coming year, and including a year-long training program for people who want to go deeper into these practices of inner, interpersonal, and systemic transformation, as well as I'm looking to co-create an experimental community center, a place where a small group of people are living, and we also host people to be living intentionally, to be cultivating practices that care for personal and collective well-being. Mm. So that's a bit of what I'm up to. There's other things I do as a consultant and as a counselor and as a coach and a trainer, but that's kind of a little bit more peripheral, but still all related.
Yeah, and I love this framing that you mentioned of like personal, interpersonal, systemic, and super curious to hear more about how the things you do operate on each of those levels and how they move through each of those levels and what your journey has been with, yeah, how you interact, how you've developed yourself, how you've developed your interpersonal propensities and how you've developed your experience with, well, systems is one. I was going to say communities, but I wonder, yeah, perhaps also curious to know more about when you say systems, what does that mean in this framework? So where to go first? I guess I'm curious where it all started for you.
Yeah, in terms of where it all started. My parents were immigrants to the United States from Belgium. And so they really settled in the US more permanently just a few months before I was born. And having the experience of being sort of dislocated or being growing up in a culture which didn't feel entirely my own. I mean, I certainly grew up an American citizen. On the one hand, I am a dual national. I'm also a European citizen, a Belgian citizen. But growing up in a culture where I didn't feel completely at home in a strange way, because my parents really reinforced more Belgian and European identity at home, and a lot of cultural influence from Belgium. I think from that point, I had a strong sense of wanting to get back to some place of belonging that my parents sort of evoked or spoke of explicitly that I didn't quite feel growing up in suburban or kind of, you know, middle-class America in the Midwest. And so I remember struggling to find belonging within the American culture. Mm. And so I'd say even at that age, I remember also at the age of 7 or so going to Belgium for a trip with my family and having the experience of being in an extended family, being in a place where people knew their neighbors really well, where 3 generations of family were all within walking distance of one another, where my great uncle was growing fruit trees and a giant garden, and my cousins who were my age, you know, we would play and we would pick fruit from the trees and we would, you know, be able to interact with in this natural world that was also a social world, which was deeply familiar and to the people living there, like that people knew everyone in the town, and people came together, 3 generations of family would come together on a weekly basis. And for me, feeling such a lack of that sense of belonging in the United States, I really felt the contrast. I felt, oh, this is what belonging to place and to people and to culture and community and to family can feel like. Oh, and I don't have that where I'm living most of the time. And so already I think there is this hunger for how do I recreate or rediscover that sense of belonging. And so I could say a lot more, but that's at least one of the touch points that I remember, that trip to Belgium as a child and how it evoked something really deep for me.
Yeah, so interesting. So it's, I guess what I'm hearing is, there was this massive contrast between growing up in North America without a sense of that multi-generational organic kind of community, actually making me think of my own upbringing where, I grew up somewhere that was not where my parents were from, but I did have a sense of feeling like, going picking apples in the orchard. And I grew up in a little village with a lot of friends around, and I had a sense of community. And then I think it diminished in my teenage years, and it's come and gone. And so with a different kind of arc, I'm also like searching for that. But what I see in your path is that you've actually created a bunch of communities, and you've gone into, I wonder if it's, was there like a conscious sense of, oh, I want to redesign this thing that I found in Belgium when I went to visit? Or, and how did you think about that as you got older? And when you became an adult, what happened there?
Yeah, you may need to remind me of some of those touch points along the way, but what comes to me, I didn't explicitly have the idea, oh, I want to recreate what I felt in Belgium, but certainly that those experiences in Belgium as a child and even as a teenager then when I went back were really evocative or inspired me a lot about, oh, this is what it could feel like to feel a sense of more belonging and connection. As well as connection to the land and to like our food source and things like that. And so other experiences also, like I remember when I was something like 16, 17 years old, I went to a summer camp. It was actually a German language immersion summer camp in the United States where we were speaking in German or learning German a lot of the time. And I felt a remarkable sense of warm, open-hearted community. Also with a lot of varied physical activities and artistic activities and sort of even political awareness awakening as a teenager and a range of different, you know, boys and girls and even adults then in the counselors, you know, a really rich community and social life. And that also gave me a taste of like, oh, wow, like, wouldn't I want to live this way? You know, and then I think when I went to university in the United States and also did some study in Europe, I think for many people that time in university is a really powerful sense of like, oh my gosh, like a place where I can learn, where I'm in walking distance from my friends and I certainly, and where I could spend time in nature and being active in all these ways, have all these resources at my fingertips. I also really found that time quite rich. And from there, I do remember already consciously thinking in my young 20s, okay, you know, how can we create more communities of this kind? And so over time, once I learned about the whole eco-village movement and the intentional communities movement, I became really fascinated with intentional communities and eco-villages and went to visit, for example, Findhorn in Scotland, which is a notable eco-village, and was really inspired. Lived in a co-op during my graduate school years in the United States, lived in a large student co-op with 150 students where we had our own constitution, we owned the co-op, we owned shares, we really had an entire economy that we ran.
What was the physical living situation like with 150 people?
We had basically like a giant dormitory, which I think had probably previously been owned by the University of Michigan, where I went to graduate school, but the student cooperative had bought that dormitory or bought that facility and basically turned it into a 150 person co-op. So yeah, it was remarkable. And there were other houses too associated with that co-op network, but that was the largest, the one that I lived in. Yeah. And so all of those experiences gave me very practical experience. Like, okay, this is possible. Right. We can create entirely different, or at least we can create ways of living and being together that to me felt much more satisfying than sort of the status quo individual nuclear family in a home, or people living alone in an apartment or something like that.
Yeah, so much there. That co-op experience of like having your own governance mechanism, there's something I've not had so explicitly anywhere I've lived. I've been in a bunch of different times in my life where I've lived quite tightly with community, but it's never been like collaboratively designed in that way. So I'm curious, like, how challenging is it to do that? There's also this, like, so many people are searching for community. So it sounds like you found it a bunch of times, and I'm wondering if you see a reason why others find it hard to find community. Like, what is it that's keeping people, what's the barrier between people feeling isolated and getting into community? my sense is like a lot of people would be open to exploring this if they could, and they don't know how, or they don't, or there's something holding them back. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a number of different factors, as you say. I think probably the biggest obstacle from my anecdotal experience with people is not knowing where to start, you know, like not knowing what options are even out there in some cases. So that certainly is one obstacle. And so for me, a big one is just letting people know, like, there are all these different ways of being together. You know, there are these intentional communities in eco-villages, there are co-housing communities around the world. There are many ways we can choose to live together. I mean, in my case, the smaller intentional communities that I've founded or co-founded in the United States have really been just myself and some friends renting a house together and starting that way. Admittedly, that's a strategy of like sharing a house is probably more appealing to people younger in their lives or who are up for a more alternative lifestyle. In some cases, people weren't super young. They actually had children in some cases, but we had to find a big enough house and people were willing to be creative. But co-housing, for example, is a strategy that is picking up a lot of momentum, I'd say, particularly in North America and I believe in Europe as well. And the thing with that is that either people need to find a community that has space available, which I think can be a bit of a limiting factor. I think there's increasing demand for the more successful existing communities, or they need to develop a community from scratch, which is usually a multi-year endeavor, particularly if we're talking about something like co-housing as opposed to simply renting a house. You know, that might be easier for younger people who don't mind sharing a house. But if you actually want to have your own home within a community and you're wanting to start something new, that is. And they're
can
also.
You distinguish between co-housing and like a share house?
Sure. Yeah, the way I think of co-housing, and of course there people might have different definitions here, but a shared house, which is what I've done multiple times, and I've also lived in co-housing, but okay, in terms of a shared house, it would be anywhere between, you know, 2-3 people up to, I've actually lived at one point in a single house in Berkeley, California with 17 people. It was a very large house. We did have our own bedrooms, or except some couples who were sharing rooms. So, you know, in a giant house where basically in most of those cases, we had one kitchen that we were sharing. There were multiple bathrooms, but there's basically kind of like one entrance, one living room, one kitchen, and then you're sharing the house. So that would be the shared house option versus co-housing, which is a model which I believe came originally from Scandinavia, and which is much more like a condominium association where people have their individual homes. So people own their own home typically, and then there's a common house. And the common house is a place where there are sometimes common meals. So people take turns cooking for the entire community. In some communities that might be once a week, in some communities that might be multiple nights a week. And with these co-housing communities, they often were formed so that people could, yes, on the one hand, have more connection and belonging, but a lot of times it was done to save money and to collaborate on things like childcare. So it's like it can be really appealing for a lot of families. Yeah. And it allows what I think works, what makes co-housing work so well for like Western, you know, contemporary people is that it allows for both privacy on the one hand, you have your own home, you can have your own castle, and at the same time, you do have social connection out the door, and there's usually, you know, right outside the door, and there's usually a higher value placed on connection, knowing your neighbors, coming together for events, and kind of keeping cars outside of the community, parking outside of the community, so that there's a safe space for children to play, so that parents can care for children collaboratively, etc. So I think a lot of needs get met by a strategy like co-housing.
And then there's co-ops. So there's this access, which I don't have a good map of, but I'd love you to perhaps, I mean, is there an access from like co-living, shared house, co-living, co-op, which is perhaps like a greater sense of commitment to the community? And is there, are there other models along that axis?
Yeah, so a co-op, in my way of thinking of that term, or a cooperative, right, is typically referring to some degree of cooperative ownership. And so that can, the degrees of cooperation can vary along a spectrum, absolutely. So there are some intentional communities which are quite limited in the amount of sharing. So for example, as I mentioned something like co-housing, people own their houses typically individually.
Yeah.
They are sole owners of those houses, and then they are partial, they have shared access to a common house. And so that's maybe at the lower end of the spectrum of sort of shared yeah. ownership. And then there's some communities like the co-op that I lived in graduate school, where we actually owned shares together in the whole co-op, and then you had access to one room within that co-op. And then there are some communities, sometimes called egalitarian communities, where they're actually doing income sharing as well. So there's actually like a deeper degree of economic interdependence. So
is Tamara one example? Did they do that?
I don't believe that Tamara necessarily involves income sharing. I mean, when I lived at Findhorn, one thing that was notable at that community to me was that everyone who was working within the foundation, which was a nonprofit organization that owned a lot of the housing and which employed a certain number of people within the community, everybody was paid the same. So it's like we all received the same sort of pay rate. And then we also had housing and food with, in addition to that within. And so that certainly is to me an amazing leveling mechanism or egalitarian sort of economic structure, which is pretty novel.
Yeah, so much there that I'd like to dig into. I'm like curious how, what challenges come out of egalitarian pay structures, because I guess I imagine some people are like, this person's not pulling their weight enough, or so why are they deserving of the same as everyone else, or I'm doing more valuable stuff than other people. And I wonder, is that something that happens? And if so, what tools and frameworks are used to kind of work through those things? Yeah.
Yeah, so in terms of work contribution and how to make community function well in terms of people's contribution, it's not so dissimilar to what we would see in any other economic system, in my view, or any other, is that it is important to have accountability structures. So in other words, how do we make sure that people contribute, do their job in a sense within a structure? And so there's different ways to do that. I don't think, they don't have to be top down. They don't have to be punitive or coercive. What you can have is a more cooperative way of sort of allocating different responsibilities and then also holding each other accountable for those. And so we see that through things like Frederic Laloux's book, Reinventing Organizations, I think is a notable example of a book that describes the range of different organizations, both corporations, nonprofit organizations, etc., around the world, that are employing a more power-sharing model, but still having accountability, where people are still held accountable for doing their job within a structure, even if it's one that they have helped design. They maybe have helped design what their jobs and accountabilities are, but that they do have accountability to their colleagues. And if they don't do their job, then there are consequences within the structure. So I think in that sense, I understand why
there could be concerns, and at the same time about like, oh, you know, do we want to experiment with something more egalitarian? I think there are tensions that arise, and this is, I mean, if you want to go down that route, we could go down it in terms of looking at economics of community. You know, I think one of the stressors on kibbutzim, from what I understand, the communities in Israel that have a strong history of egalitarianism, is that some people who could be generating a lot more income didn't want to be sharing their income. Mm-hmm. And I certainly have seen that stress, tension come up even at Findhorn at times. Like, I had already 2 graduate degrees when I was living and working there. And so, you know, arguably in the mainstream economy, I could be paid much more than I was being paid there.
Yeah.
For me, it was worth the trade-off. I really loved my life there. I loved my experience there, and I value egalitarianism in a lot of ways. And it's true that I do also value, however, a community and an economic system which holds us accountable for our contribution to the well-being of the whole. But also, you know, to what degree do we want to allow sort of flexibility, or to take into account, for example, somebody who's elderly or somebody who has certain limitations that make it harder for them to work at the same rate. I think, again, I don't think I have the answers, but I think that it's important for us to be considering ways that we can support everybody to thrive in a way that maybe doesn't involve everybody being paid the exact same amount, but where we actually spread the wealth around a bit better than is currently happening in a lot of parts of the world, so that everybody can not only survive, but actually thrive and be well enough to make their best contribution to the collective, which I don't think is happening.
Yeah.
To the collective, meaning to the wider society or to the community.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a world, especially in the West, where so many of us are so isolated. Like, something like 20% of Americans have 0 people to call on an emergency. It's like they have no connection whatsoever. And then there's this complete other end of the spectrum where we can actually live together and support one another, and we can opt into systems where, I mean, I think just in terms of like rational personal security, if we want to be as an individual living in a system that supports us long term, being part of a community that looks after the elderly when they're not able to contribute economically, it makes sense. I do care a lot about these people who feel so outside of connection and outside of community. And as someone, even myself, who's searching for some kind of community, and I want to experiment with different models, and that's why I've come to this place. I'm curious how you define where we're living right now. So we're in this pretty big house. Is this, I don't know if this is defined as where that goes on that spectrum. We kind of share responsibilities. We have a little bit of responsibility. We have a lot of personal autonomy as well. And there's not like shared financial resources or anything like that. And it's a temporary structure as well, to an extent, although it's part of a longer term network that involves a lot of research and learning and building in the areas that you're super interested in. Where am I going with this? Yeah, so is it possible to dip into, how do people go about dipping into these systems that are like, come here and we share our resources? Is that something that people can people in general, are communities available for like short-term commitment, or do places like Findhorn require people to go there and say, I'm gonna what is the sign-up process for different communities, and how much commitment is needed for various ones? You've also like established a number of your own communities over the years, and how have you gone about thinking about what people are signing up for when they come to join those?
Mm-hmm. So I A lot of intentional communities and eco-villages do have an initial sort of visiting program of some kind of a guest program or experience week, it was called at Findhorn. And so that gives people an opportunity to come for a week and experience community life. Often there's, you know, some facilitated activities as well as an opportunity to participate in the daily rhythms of the community, whether it's working in the kitchen or cleaning or working in the gardens, as well as a chance to ask questions or hear about community life. So I think that's a great strategy, you know, is for people to visit communities, or some communities have an open house or an open day where people can come and experience the community. So looking out for that, searching out communities and finding, and there are directories of communities. So there's the Foundation of Intentional Communities, which is at ic.org. There's the Global Ecovillage Network. There's the co-housing network, or at least there's a co-housing association for North America, I know, and then I believe there might be others in the world. So there are various online and even paper examples of directories of communities that people can seek out. And then many of these communities, the ones that are open to visitors, have different everything from a meal to a day to a week, sort of opportunities to experience those communities. So I think those are great ways for people to like get a taste of community. And then there are places that have longer programs as well. Some might involve, you know, a month or more. I think just I'll mention, because depending on which path you want to follow, there's a lot of places we could go in this conversation, I sense, and I'm really happy to follow where you'd like it to go. But there are also ways that I am interested in supporting people, and this is a lot of what I've been doing as well, is like how to support people to build community right where they are. So yes, of course, it's great that there are these new models or like experimental models happening in different places where people move to a new location or build something new, but I don't know that that's the most viable strategy for all of humanity, right? Like we can't all be relocating to, especially not to building up new communities. So how can we in our existing neighborhood, whether we're living urban or rural, how can we weave more community right where we are, which may not mean living necessarily physically more in the same structure with people, but we can have a lot more community. And I think the range of strategies there is infinite, and that's something I've been really excited about and trying to support people in, is like how do we weave community in person and online. But I must say I'm quite interested in person as well as online. So I could say we could explore more around that if you like.
Yeah, so there's like a very different model of people finding connection, which might be a lot easier for some people because the logistics of like going to a new place could be just one of the big prohibitive factors for a lot of people. People need to, maybe they have a stable job or a family or commitments in their local area. And so if people are desirous of a greater sense of community, as I think most are, there's ways to do that locally also. There's ways both to cultivate that or to join existing structures and networks and activities in one's local area. I've been kind of inspired by these. There's a couple of projects called The Neighborhood New York and The Neighborhood San Francisco. I don't know if you've seen these at all. And a bunch of people have kind of targeted a certain area where they've rented houses within proximity to each other and created like co-working spaces and community events in a very small area of these cities, so that hundreds of people who have a lot of overlapping sort of ideas about how they want to live and what they want to do with their lives can be in a kind of like campus-like environment, but within the city. And so they just have these organic connections where they just bump into each other at the cafe or in the street, or they work from the same place. And that's like, I passed through the one in San Francisco briefly, and it was, Yeah, it was really cool to see like all the different projects emerging from that, all the friendships that people were cultivating there. But as you point toward, there's so many different ways of finding connection and community locally. Yeah, I wonder what spring to mind as the ones which are like most, well, there's like, I think there's like easiness of access and then there's like depth of meaning, and maybe those two things aren't necessarily the same thing. So yeah, curious what different options are out there for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of these may be obvious and things that people are already very much aware of, but I'll just say I've been really struck by the impact of a range of different strategies, whether it's like finding just a local activity or club, or, you know, for me, it was actually like finding a martial arts club. Like, so going to a local Aikido dojo was, in a couple of cases, like really instrumental to my social life and to a sense of belonging and connection. So whatever that activity is, whether it's running, whether it's tennis, whether it's yoga, you know, finding an activity with other people and making that a regular rhythm in one's life and engaging with the people there. Like, of course, some of these activities have more community than others, but many of them, I think, can be an amazing way to deepen in connection. And those have been very instrumental for me. Another set of strategies for me has been hosting different things at my home. And that's varied from, you know, again, like a simple strategy, but just like having a regular, you know, dinner or a potluck, or, you know, when I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, I would just host a Friday night potluck at my house, and just it gained momentum. Yeah. You know, it's just like people knew Friday night at this place, you know, there's this potluck and there are interesting people and we're doing different activities, or we're just hanging out and talking. And, you know, it just showed me how much hunger there was, because once I was willing to anchor that kind of place, more and more people showed up and there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. And it doesn't have to be, in my view, something where I have to expend a ton of resources around it. I mean, I do, if I want to be hosting it regularly, and I don't have to do it weekly, I could do it monthly, I could do it some other rhythm, or we could rotate between houses in a group of friends. It can make it a potluck so that everybody's contributing, or again, we could rotate who does the cooking. So that's, to me, a tremendous strategy, and you can make it thematic if you want, you know, whether it's like, maybe it's a dinner and a movie night, or maybe it's dinner and games night, you know, playing board games, or maybe it's dinner and somebody taking turn giving a presentation on something they care about. But like, whatever somebody is passionate about, like following their bliss in that sense and just like flying a flag for that, to me is such a potent way to build community. And I guess similar to that, you know, apart from just the dinner aspect, is that I've hosted like a practice group of various kinds. Like, I've hosted, it's similar like a book club almost. So the book clubs, I think, are a great strategy. But, you know, I've hosted practice groups around nonviolent communication. I've hosted different groups around spiritual practice or meditation. And, you know, those have lasted for years and have become lifelong friendships, you know, people who I'm still very close to 10 plus years later from these kinds of groups. Yeah. In fact, I think of, one friend who I've known for over 20 years, I got to know her because I put up a flyer in my university town inviting people who are interested in coming together around voluntary simplicity to meet together. And, you know, we've been friends ever since. So yeah, I think there's just lots of strategies like that. But I think the key is like, find what lights you up, what would you enjoy doing with other people?
Right. Yeah. Hearing you talk about this, like so many memories of times in my life where I've had these things, or various things, which I think I just want to list off for people to give some more ideas here, come to mind. Yeah. And they often do take very little, or it just takes someone starting something, and others are willing to get involved. And I think like offering to like volunteer a bit of time to help these kind of projects is often like a really good way to get greater connection with people, because when you're working on something together, there's just you get to spend more time with each other, and you get to know each other better, and that has often been a really good way to that I've formed closer friendships. Yeah, potlucks, drum circles, people have just brought like hand drums to the park and played the drums, being in a sports team. I think, yeah, it's easy to think, oh, I can't do that, I'm not like fit or healthy enough, so I can't do sport. But there are sports out there which are really welcoming to people of all levels, and I think some are harder than others, but I think often there's stuff like Ultimate Frisbee or Dragon Boat Racing, I found have both been like really welcoming of people of all levels. Organizing a potluck, yeah, and then it's very little work. People bring their own food, and just if you live somewhere with good weather as well, you can just like meet outdoors. It's beautiful. I used to go to this thing my friend organized in Taipei called the Really Really Free Market, and people would just bring stuff they didn't want anymore and good stuff, and it was just like hundreds of people would go there, and we'd spend all day in the park just hanging out, having a picnic, really. Poker night with friends, like really good weekly fun event. And if people don't have anybody they can invite, it's actually a way to find people to bring into your life. Like you said, you just posted a thing up on the wall in your local town, and people see that and can contact you and come along. And so you can start from scratch and with like very little effort, and things can emerge from there. You also talk about practice communities like nonviolent communication, and I've run authentic relating workshops, and I started doing that with like very little experience, and I just framed it as, hey, let's learn together. I don't know about this. You don't know about this. If anyone wants to learn this together, we can come together and practice. And so even if there's like, no, if you don't have a skill set, but there's something you want to know, there's an opportunity both to learn and to meet other people along the way. And that's a really great way to grow together as well, I find. There's so many like practices you have cultivated, and I want to dive into those. And I'm curious how they tie into community, because community, obviously, great, we all get to connect, but there's a tent, we're human beings as well, and tensions have emerged, and we've lived here for like 3 or 4 weeks, and tensions have emerged here, and you've been a really great figure in helping people in this house navigate some stuff. And so I'm curious, when you think, well, what kinds of tensions do you, I want to ask you, like, what's the most difficult relational thing that's ever come up in a community you've been in, if you're answering that question, and like, how was that or like the most successfully navigated relational tension that comes to mind, and what did it take to get through that, if that's a question that you find an answer to?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I have the best sense always of what's the most XYZ kind of thing, but I can name some notable examples around tension and conflict. So yeah, that has ended up being one of my professional areas of expertise is facilitating conflict transformation and helping communities and organizations navigate conflict. And it really did emerge from... Well, my interest in social change, my interest in how can we create a better world, just to give you a bit of background to how I came to conflict resolution work, it's like I was actually really interested in environmental issues, and yet I saw how much conflict was arising both within groups who are interested in the environment, like there was inner group conflict, but then also people, myself included, like wanting to make a difference in the world, but doing so with such a sort of accusing and aggressive kind of tone that I ended up, you know, in arguments with people who didn't hold my views. And by being in argument, I really quickly noticed, it's like, I don't think I'm actually making headway. Like, I don't think I'm actually achieving what I'm hoping to achieve by trying to argue with people about these issues. And then when I actually began to see some more skillful people embodying empathy and actually connecting with people with different views, I saw the tremendous potency of actually bridging between people with different beliefs rather than trying to convince them. And so that's what really first inspired me into the work of conflict resolution and communication. So with that said, I've been doing that work for now quite a few years, a couple decades, and
it does in any community I've been a part of, just like any organization, like any family, like any relationship, you know, conflict is a natural part of any relationship. And yet they're more, I would say, healthy or functional, and more dysfunctional or damaging ways we can navigate conflict. Mm. And in fact, trying to avoid conflict, which happens a lot in some cultures or subcultures, or, you know, a lot of us do that because conflict has gone badly for us in our lives, so we tend to avoid it. But sadly, by avoiding it, it doesn't go away, it just goes underground, and then it comes bursting out the sides in even more destructive ways sometimes. So all of that said, I would say some of the conflicts that have been most challenging to navigate in community have to do with some kind of sexual boundary crossing, because understandably it touches a appropriately deep place of fear in people, a deep sense of violation, and can in many cases, you know, be related to, be very deeply traumatic. And so the impact of that can have so much pain, and that can really break trust tremendously between people. And so that's been the most challenging kind of conflict that I've navigated, that I can think of. And I've certainly, fortunately, been in situations where it's, where we've been able to navigate that relatively successfully, and, and actually lead to some healing and to a sense of greater well-being. And I've also been in situations where it's not seemed possible. It's only been possible to sort of ease some of the pain and just like try to find the most, the least damaging way to have sort of boundaries and separation between people, which I think is sometimes the best we can do given the complexity of those situations. But fortunately, that's not the majority of the kinds of conflicts that come up in any kind of organization or relationship or family or community. You know, there's the day-to-day sorts of things, like, you know, cleaning the dishes, like, you know, pulling our weight, which you talked about before, like contributing our fair share to the well-being of the whole.
I'm curious what approaches do you take, and like, what tools do you use to navigate the things? What in practice is happening when, I guess it's like different levels of intensity you talk about, like not washing the dishes versus like sexual boundaries being crossed and everything in between. What does it look like to work on those problems in a way that's like not doing this thing what you talked about before, which is just like expressing your view and very unlikely to be heard? How does one facilitate or take part in those conversations in a way that, what approach should one take in situations where conflict is there to try to get through it in a way that reaches harmony?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are both specific skills that I think are really tremendously helpful for individuals and communities and organizations and families to navigate conflict. And so there's sort of whole sets of methodologies like nonviolent communication. And then within things like nonviolent communication or other methods, there are then sub skills within that. So empathic listening. So in other words, the ability to slow down when somebody else is upset or when I'm upset, and to really check and make sure that I'm really understanding what somebody else is saying before I come in with my argument or before I come in with my different perspective. So that's a skill that people can learn and practice. And so that's one that I train people in and that I aspire to practice myself. It's not just about empathizing with other people, but it's also really important for people to learn to empathize with themselves, or what I call sometimes self-connect or self-regulate. How do we regulate our own nervous systems? Mm. How, when I'm upset, when somebody has done something that I found upsetting, or when I've had a stressful day, etc.,
how can I learn to pause, notice what's happening inside myself, calm my nervous system down? And again, there's a range of strategies, from meditation to taking a walk to journaling to finding a friend to listen to me to going and exercising to doing some other kind of practice. But giving people concrete tools for these personal and interpersonal skills, how to mediate conflicts. So these are all competencies that we can, and I do work with people on developing. The other thing that I would say, though, that is, I think, very, very helpful in community or any kind of group of humans, is to actually have what I would call a system or a set of agreements around how we intend to deal with interpersonal tensions and conflict, because they inevitably do come up. And if we're aware that we're going to have that kind of challenge, it's great to then have some agreed upon strategies. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like having a poster on the wall for what do you do if there's a fire, like, oh, go to this exit, pull this, you know, press this button, you know, etc. The same for conflict, that we know, okay, in this community, here are the resources available, call this person, or, you know, we come together on Tuesday evenings to talk about tensions, mm-hmm. or, you know, here's where the time of the month when we do some training, or, you know, like, how do we have a set of agreements? So that's something that I work with organizations on, is developing a system for responding to interpersonal tensions and conflicts, so that we really can have a well thought through and well supported strategy for dealing with those kinds of challenges.
Yeah. So there's like a bunch of different practices that people can work on to like up our skills. I guess I see people like neglecting this massively. I until maybe 5 or 6 years ago put pretty much no time whatsoever in cultivating my ability, my relational skills, I guess what I'll call them. And also my self-awareness, also almost no time cultivating that whatsoever until a similar point. And so I thought about, how do I increase my knowledge? How do I increase my health, my physical health? And I just completely didn't think it was something. I didn't even know it was something I could put time into. That, like, oh, I can massively upgrade my ability to navigate conflict, to name my emotions, to have more harmonious relationships. And so having started that journey, it's totally transformed my life. And so now my relationships are able to be much healthier, and I'm able to connect with people in a way I couldn't before. And that's, yeah, something I just want to try to give it's good to have options. And if that's something people want in their life, they can actually go out there and look at the bits of their way of being that they want to work to cultivate more. And so you talked about like the subcomponents of nonviolent communication, such as like empathetic listening, and so powerful. And then agreements within organizations or within groups living together, it builds the awareness that, oh, we're bound to have difficulties sometimes, and when they emerge, then perhaps there's like a little bit less weight put on them. It's like, this is the natural part of the undulation of living together or working together or being together. And so when it happens, it's like, oh, well, it's not out of the blue. Although this might be a new specific phenomenon, this is part of being human. And we also have a structure in place, and we've got protocols. I think also even within like one-to-one relationships, it's these check-ins and sort of approaches to difficulty have been really useful for me in recent years. Just like, oh, when we have a disagreement, we can like talk about it in a certain kind of way using a certain set of tools, and that's been really potent as well. And so right now we're living in this house in France with between like 8 to 11 people it's been so far, something like that. And we have a few different we have a little bit of a framework here and some approaches we use when difficulties emerge. I wonder if you could speak to like your experience in this house so far. What tools have been used? What framework do we have here? And what do you think's going well and how are you feeling about this structure and all that here?
So as I see it, the community we're living in right now is a temporary co-living situation. So people are here for anywhere between a week to a few months. So because it's somewhat temporary, you know, it means that there might be less willingness or less reason to invest a lot of energy in building up a strong, strong degree of culture and connection and system. But nonetheless, I mean, we are in each other's lives, and so we're definitely impacting each other as well in really beautiful ways, like enjoying life together. And also, of course, any kind of living together, there's going to be some tensions that arise as well. I mean, I think one of the things that we're doing that is a really basic but fundamentally useful thing is that we are coming together on a weekly basis for an evening to share with each other and to hear each other, to hear what's happening. And the explicit invitation has also been made to name tensions in that space. And I think those are two great strategies, a regular space for sharing where everybody gets a chance to be heard, and two, an explicit invitation to surface tensions. Some of the rest of what I think is supporting the well-being is maybe more implicit and not as explicit mm-hmm. or not as formalized. I mean, there's a voluntary space for meditation and morning practice, which I think can actually be a remarkably helpful thing, both because I think meditation can help people self-regulate and kind of care for their personal, mental, and emotional well-being. But it's also somehow when people do the something like that together, it's interestingly bonding, even though they may not be talking when it's happening. We've also been, you've been facilitating some authentic relating games, and we've done some circling. And I think those are both great strategies as well for people just building connection, trust, closeness. What has also happened a bit is that when I've noticed tension arising sort of spontaneously in moments, whether it's in a meeting, whether it's over a meal, whether it's in another situation, I've tried and others have tried to slow the conversation down a bit, sometimes explicitly inviting, oh, could we slow down or could we pause? And also then offering some reflection to somebody who seems distressed or upset. So in other words, saying to somebody who seems like they might have some distress or upset in a particular moment, saying what we think we hear them saying or what we hear is important to them. It doesn't need to be super formalized. It doesn't need to be exact reflecting back of their words, but just letting them know like, hey, is this what's important to you? Like, I'm wondering if this matters to you. That I find can be so helpful for that person to have a sense of being heard, for other people to have a sense of understanding that person. And it just slows down and brings more awareness to the interaction. So that alone, I think, has made a difference in a number of interactions. Yeah. And then a third, more significant intervention has been, I think, just on one occasion that I've explicitly invited a conscious conversation between multiple people with the intention to bring more connection or move through tension or conflict. And so that was voluntary for everybody involved. And that did involve me helping to slow down the conversation and seemed to lead to a lot more connection where there was a lot of disconnection and upset.
Yeah, some really powerful tools there. I've noticed the power of that. Just when somebody's nervous system's all amped up and they're kind of triggered or upset in an argument or in a discussion or a heated conversation, yeah, just reflecting to them in an empathetic way. I notice you're feeling this and that, and just showing them that you hear them and you see them is it just lowers the temperature immediately, almost always. It's like, yeah, that is what I'm feeling and hearing, and they, there's a feeling of in them of being seen, and it's massive when that happens, and it's so powerful. Yeah. There was a thread earlier which I wanted to go back to, but I wonder if there's also more here. Yeah, well, you said you were talking before about how there's this real challenge when trying to instigate social change and just conveying our viewpoint ardently and passionately doesn't usually like have a the effect we want on persuading people of our viewpoint. It can often just lead to butting of heads across beliefs. I think this and questions around it are some of the most important we face as a species. How do we cultivate empathy, and how do we collaborate in the face of differences of belief, different desired outcomes for the world, both between cultures, within countries, between nation states, between individuals? There's a real challenge there, and I think ultimately it risks destroying the entire planet. But it also regularly tears families apart, relationships are permanently destroyed, because it's really challenging to retain empathy and collaboration in the face of difference, like strong differences of opinion. What do you see? Well, you talked about your own personal transformation there, as having previously been in a place where you showed up in a way that you kind of don't advocate for now. And so what changed in your approach? What did you learn? And what do you see as the way forward?
Well, I'll tell a little story which I sometimes share in terms of how I got into this work, because I think it gives a really kind of concrete example of that shift. So as I mentioned previously, in graduate school at the University of Michigan, I was studying environmental policy in addition to anthropology, and so I was personally also very passionate about environmental issues, and so I was part of a student group that was working to help the university, or to, in our case, we were trying to push and advocate for more environmental sustainability within the university. And we were doing it in a, I would say, pretty challenging way toward the university and toward the university leadership. And I even found myself at one point, like in an argument with the president of the university, like in a heated argument in front of the board of regents of the university at a meeting. And, you know, it didn't go well, at least if you want to measure it by openness to what I was saying. You know, it's like I was presenting things in an argumentative way, and I got a lot of pushback. One could say maybe it was still at least advancing the agenda on some level, but I experienced a lot of closeness coming back. And so what ended up happening is that the then president of the business school, a man named Joe White, reached out to me, and he actually said, "Carl, I'd be happy to sit down and support a conversation between you and one of the vice presidents of the university." And I felt the sincerity of his offer, and I thought, wow, okay, if this president of the business school wants to meet with myself and the vice president about these issues, then great, you know, I'm going to show up for it. And what I experienced when I sat down with the two of them was that I think the president of the business school invited me to share my concerns and what I was advocating for, and I did. And then he basically reflected back what he heard was important to me. And I just had this sense of like, wow, like I just felt so heard. I had such a sense that I thought, wow, he gets it. Yeah. He's on my side. He's totally in support of where I'm coming from. And then he turned to the vice president, and he similarly invited the vice president to express what was there for him. And the Joe White, the president of the business school, like empathized with him and listened to him in such a way that the vice president felt completely heard. He was relaxed. He was open. And what I quickly realized is it's not that the president of business school, that Joe White, was simply agreeing with me. I think he actually did probably agree with the points that I was making, but he could understand me and understand the vice president in a way that really created an amazing bridge that really befriended both of us, and that
led to the vice president being so much more open to the agenda that I was bringing, and so that we could find substantive steps forward. So I'm sharing that story to give a really concrete example of something that opened my eyes. And I had real time experience of something that I had run into roadblock after roadblock, resistance, resistance, resistance. And one person's ability to empathize and mediate, it completely shifted the progress of what we were trying to achieve. So that led me to what ended up being a really years and years of study and practice, and now teaching of tools like nonviolent communication, but also things like internal family systems therapy, which is really an inner practice, but which I also find very helpful for interpersonal work, getting trained in mediation, getting trained in restorative justice. And so there are these various tools which anybody can, you know, pick up a book or do a course in person or online in things like nonviolent communication, in mediation, in internal family systems, which I think is also a really potent modality for this kind of both inner work and interpersonal work. And to be to be explicit, like the work that I'm doing now is to create different kinds of courses that can be accessible to all kinds of people at all kinds of levels, to people who are homemakers, to people who are teachers in schools, to people who are CEOs of multinational companies, to activists in the street, to social workers, like to plumbers, you name it. Like, how do we get these tools and practices accessible to everyone everywhere at the level that is useful to them, to the degree that we don't all have to be experts in conflict resolution. But I agree with what I hear you pointing toward, which is I think everybody's life can be richer, more enjoyable by learning some of these practices. And I do think that these are actual survival necessities for our species. I don't think we're going to be able to handle the challenges that we're facing, whether it's climate change, whether it's global war, whether it's, you know, migration due to climate pressure or political and economic instability. I don't think we as a species can navigate the challenges that are coming to us in the 21st century without more competency in these basic skills for human relating to ourselves and each other.
Yeah, they transform our ability to be able to navigate differences with each other, but they also transform the way we look at the world. For me, they've totally changed. They allow me to easily understand that we're all different, and I think there's just like less judgment in me, like a huge reduction in my judgment of people with different views than my own. And that's an ongoing work, but I think it's accelerating really. And just like the more I navigate with people who I have conflict with, the more I learn really underneath it all, pretty much everybody has the same desires and their beautiful desires. There's just a very different belief system in different people about how to get there. And the more we can connect with each other, the more we can understand that, the more we can coordinate together with empathy. And empathy allows for people to be open to compromise, which is ultimately essential. And everyone needs to compromise. It's just, and so it creates this outward ability to empathize, which allows for this inward ability to be flexible. At least this is my experience. I also noticed in you, in spite of having so many years of experience, you're constantly open to feedback, and like you ask of me, someone with a fraction of your skills and experience with this stuff, like how I see you showing up in interactions, and that's I think that's a great illustration of like humbleness and openness to learning constantly. And yeah, there was an interaction just the other day where you were like, I'm curious what happened there, what did you see in that interaction, was there some way I could have like shown up differently, or and stuff like that. And so that attitude to really looking at ourselves and saying, what is there, something I can do differently here that can make for growth still. I really admire that in you. We watched a video the other night from Byron Katie, who's somebody you've studied quite a lot, and I've only watched a couple of her things, and I found them both incredibly powerful, and they point towards this phenomenon we're talking about at the moment. Who is Byron Katie? What's her work about? And how? Yeah, I know you're currently like digging into her a lot. I'm wondering, is she doing something completely unique, or is she part of something broader? How do you look at Byron Katie? What's her work about, and how important is it?
Yeah, I really enjoy the work of Byron Katie, absolutely. And she's, I would call a spiritual teacher, or a teacher, certainly. And it's not the primary modality that I've gone deeper into. As I mentioned, I'd say nonviolent communication and internal family systems have been more significant parts of my life. But I really enjoy her work, which is actually called The Work, or The Work of Byron Katie. And it's, to me, very, very compatible with and complementary to the other modalities that I've mentioned that I'm interested in. And I think I'd say it's unique in that it has its own particular sort of process, questions, and features. But I think it's really consistent with other psychological and spiritual traditions. So it's, you know, I think there are these different flavors, whether it's, you know, Eckhart Tolle, whether it's Marshall Rosenberg, whether it's Richard Schwartz, you know, these are all, whether it's Buddhism, you know, these different approaches, which I think are all ultimately fingers pointing at the same moon. Like, they're different fingers, but we're all pointing at the same moon. And so they're like different pathways to the same realization. What I appreciate about Byron Katie's work is, in a sense, like the simplicity and the clarity and the rigor of the self-inquiry that's involved. It's not so much a method, immediately at least, to be working on, let's say, interpersonal conflict. It's more like the inner work part. It's a particular approach to trying to clarify our own thinking and recognize the impact that our stories have on us, and that actually the beliefs we have, especially judgments about other people, negative judgments about other people or about ourselves or about the world, that those are simply stories and they're not absolutely true, and that when we actually believe those stories, we actually live life from a more constricted and limited perspective, whereas when we're able to recognize, oh, that's a story, and it's not actually the absolute truth, and we can begin to disidentify from that belief, we have so much more flexibility, openness, and resource available to us. And so that's kind of my nutshell kind of description. I mean, another way to say it is that she also, her first book is called Loving What Is, and it's kind of a useful synopsis of her work. It's really saying, like, how can we love exactly what's happening, or at least see the gift in whatever is happening, no matter how challenging it is, to not necessarily just label it as bad, but see it as providing some kind of opportunity. And so that's a bit of a synopsis. We could go deeper into it.
Yeah, and it kind of, it feels like it has echoes of like Eastern philosophical wisdom. Though when I see her on the screen, I think, oh, this is like a therapist and a conflict mediator. But actually, the methodology is, it has this unusual purity to it. And it's like very non-coercive as well. It's like, it's so simple and so effective, the little bits I've seen. He just throws a very small tweak to a question, and it's able to shift the way the person she's talking to perceives themselves and how they're showing up in a specific relationship in a way that's always very emotional. I cried watching the thing here the other night, and I just like tears streaming down my face for the first one. Both were about adult males' relationship with their parents. And I guess there's a lot of universal truths in there, almost universal, like people, it's navigating relationships with our parents is a struggle, and what I see in her work is really powerful, and it gives me a strong, like, I'm really keen to dig into it more, to work on those particular relationships in my own life. I guess we've got up to like 15 minutes remaining, and I'm wondering if we've kind of touched on two broad areas in this conversation, I guess, of communities, community design, how we live together in groups, how we can find group connection, and then sort of more on the sort of, well, yeah, more on the personal sort of self-understanding kind of side of things and how we go about navigating our own individuality into the world when we want to affect change or when we want to be having connection or working through conflict with others. How do you think about the intersection of personal growth and existing within groups and systems? And like, what is the interplay between those things? And maybe how does one as an individual, what's an approach that is about like how we cultivate ourselves as individuals in a way that's most useful for us having the kinds of connection and impact we want in the world?
I'm particularly interested in the intersection you're describing. Like, I am a firm believer. I've just like been drawn throughout my life toward this idea of coming together with other people in ongoing, regular ways to develop ourselves in order to find better well-being at a personal level, like more personal happiness and well-being, to create healthier communities or more effective and enjoyable ways of being with other people, and to develop ourselves so that we can give our gifts more effectively to the wider world. So it's exactly that, which is really, to me, the crux of what my life's work is about. And so I see it as not only possible, but I actually personally don't see anything else as equally effective. Like, I think that in Buddhism, they use the term sangha for a community of practice. Like, to me, you know, to me, a book club is like the Western kind of term for it practically, but it's like a group of, or a church, right? It's like, it's a group of people coming together with an intention to learn and develop together and to practice something together. And I think that that's both one of the most enjoyable things to participate, and the more we really link that to meaningful contribution to the world, it's also can be a tremendous vehicle for personal growth, and it can be a tremendous vehicle for contribution to the wider society. And so that's explicitly what I've been developing in the courses and materials that I've been creating, and that I've been creating with my colleagues, is really a set of tools for people to come together with others on a regular basis. I call them in the smaller format, like pods of 3 to 5, 6 people meeting on a regular basis, whether it's once a week or every other week in person or online, to do often like inner work together or to share about our lives, or it could be any number of focuses, but to somehow share with each other, but also to give each other feedback, which to me, giving each other feedback is one of the most powerful ways to help each other grow. And also to potentially support each other on projects that make a difference in the wider world. Because again, I think that one of the things that many, many people are longing for, whether they know it or not, is to belong to a group of people who are contributing to something larger than ourselves. I think that that combination of belonging with contribution to something bigger than ourselves is magical in terms of creating well-being. And I think that, yes, of course, like people might say, oh, I don't, you know, of course we need our basic material needs met. We need shelter, we need food, etc. But in a sense, even being a part of a community of belonging, that in and of itself can make meeting those basic needs for food and shelter easier as well. So it's like I really can't emphasize enough how valuable I think it is to find a group of people of any kind of theme, you know, any kind of interest group, but like to find a group to contribute to regularly, and which ideally, from my view, a group that then ultimately also looks to contribute to the wider world. Maybe you come together to play poker once a week, but maybe every few months you go help out in the soup kitchen, or you are a running club that meets to go running every day or every week. But then you also like help out young kids who get into sports or something like that.
Yeah, brilliant. And you speak to like groups meeting, just like joining, being part of a group immediately can meet a lot of these sort of base level hierarchy of needs things in a way that perhaps is more difficult otherwise. And yeah, there's this study of, I think, over 300,000 people that shows like the difference in health outcomes between people who have like a reasonable amount of social connection and those that don't. And over a 7-year period, the reduction in mortality of those that have social connection is the same as people quitting smoking. And there's both like, I think there's an emotional component to that, but there's also just like the logistical one. When you have people who are close to you in your life, they can give you the kind of support you need when you need it. And they can loan you some money if you're broke, or they can like help you out when you need, when you've been to hospital for an operation. And these things really allow us to get the base level things met, so that then we can work more on like having a sense of meaning and purpose. You also talked about this model of pods. I'm curious, is that the same? So your friends with Rich, who founded or came up with the micro solidarity framework, and part of that is this idea of crews, which is like 4 to 6 people, I think, meeting frequently. When you say pods, is there something the same there as a crew, or is there a difference?
Yeah, to me the terms are more or less interchangeable, although at least in the pods that I've been forming, there might be a bit more of an emphasis on the specifically including some of the personal development work and a regular rhythm of the interpersonal feedback. And at least in the pods, the networks that I've been working with and cultivating, we really try to make sure that there is that kind of a conflict, like emotional support and conflict facilitation system for the wider network, because I think that can really help address any tensions or conflicts that arise both within a pod or within a crew, as well as in the wider community.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. So there's been a lot of wisdom in here, I think, around how we can cultivate ourselves to show up in the world in a way that might actually get our needs met more. And that also, like, where we can go to find community and connection, and then like what different models are out there of community, that if people want to join community longer term, or if they just want to build a sense of community into where they are right now. For people who are like feeling the need for more interpersonal nourishment in their life, is there like a simple piece of wisdom you might give? Or advice.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of what we've spoken to today point to the kinds of things that I think would be most helpful for someone who's looking for more connection and well-being. The thing that comes to me is find the one or two regular practices that you want to experiment with, or that you already know that you enjoy, whether it's journaling, whether it's running, whether it's walking, whether it's playing games, and ideally try to find other people to connect with around that on a regular basis. So just keeping it that simple, and just like keep following what feels good, keep following what feels supportive, and sharing that with other people. And then, you know, over time, I think getting real with each other about like, what are our needs? How can we help each other out in life? How can we, you know, I think many people are hungering for more connection and belonging. And so if we can actually acknowledge that to the people we're in connection with, in just a way that invites every other people to feel like, oh wow, here's somebody who's naming this thing, I feel this too, like that immediately can create a bridge and create more of a sense of safety for this kind of conversation to happen, and is makes it much more likely that we'll all be able to meet our needs more and create more connection.
Yeah, I think you point towards like naming this desire for more connection, and that can feel vulnerable and challenging, but it's so valuable. And it could be done in a message, if feeling like saying it face to face is too hard. Like there's a very simple version of that where you just message someone and say, hey, I'm feeling like I'd like to connect, or I want to spend more time with you, or I'm feeling a bit lonely. Like, yeah. Because I'm wondering, for some people, joining or starting a group even might feel quite scary. They might feel social anxiety if they haven't spent time with people for a long time, or if they've kind of had experiences of not being socially accepted in the past. Is there any advice you would give to people who haven't had much connection and would like to find a way to bring that into their life?
I think of this idea of, you know, starting a journey of a 1,000 miles, you know, it begins with one step, right? It's like, find the little easy steps, whether it's like reaching out to one person. And, you know, for some people, maybe online is going to be an easier bridge, you know, than in person, but it really depends on the person. But it's like, is it, you know, going to a neighbor and saying, do you want to take a walk? Is it inviting one person over for a meal? Is it, or to go out for a meal? Mm. Is it to find some kind of forum online and joining there? Again, I think these things are personal in the sense that it's not one size fits all. Like, people need different flavors of connection, and different things kind of are easier for some people than for others. And I hope that what we've talked about so far in this conversation gives kind of a range of ideas that might inspire, like, okay, yeah, like, huh, I like toy trains. Like, I, you know, let me go to the local hobby store and, you know, just like, I think they might have an event every once in a while for people who are interested in the latest, you know, models, you know?
Yeah. Great. Yeah. I find it can be overwhelming to think like long-term, this is like the thing I want is a flourishing community full of friends who support me, and I will feel confident and charismatic, and optimizing for the start line can be a lot easier. And like, just like when I want to go to the gym and I feel some resistance and I think about, oh, I've got to have a whole workout, it's like there's too much resistance there. But if my goal is just to put my shoes on, then it's like I can do that. And the action precedes the momentum. And then I see in friends who feel a little socially anxious sometimes, once they take a step and they have some connection, it reduces the friction. And it actually creates some like positive emotion, and like some, I don't know, some hormones probably get released, and there's just like a sense of well-being and a greater sense of ease for the next step. And so I think that's a great advice. Yeah, like the journey of 1,000 miles starts with, is it 1,000 miles? Starts with a single step. Yeah. I love that. Yeah, So the last episode, we tried to think of a single word or action or image to summarize the conversation. And I wonder if anything comes to mind for you as a word, movement, an image, or anything else.
I like the invitation of an image. And so what comes to me is having one hand on my heart and one hand reaching out like this. And so there's something about that, about on the one hand really feeling myself, like self-connecting, self-empathizing, caring well or listening well inside to my own well-being, and then also being able to reach out and somehow signal, as we were just saying, about like
letting people know that we care about something, or letting them know that we have a need for connection, or a need for belonging, or a longing for community, you know, that combination of self-connection and reaching out, that symbolizes a lot for me.
Yeah, that's great. I'll go with that one as well. If you've enjoyed this conversation, feel free to hit the like, the subscribe, the notification bell. I keep forgetting to tell people to do that. But if this kind of conversation resonates, then we'd love to have you back on the channel. Carl, thank you so much. That was full of juice and just so many avenues that I'd like to plow further with you. So maybe we'll do that on camera another time, or definitely off camera as well. Thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge and wisdom and experience. If people want to find you online, what kind of things are you offering at the moment, and where can they find you?
Yeah, thanks, Simo. I've really enjoyed the conversation as well, and we could spend hours and hours on all of this, and so we look forward to more. Right now, best place to connect with me would be at my website, which is carlsteyert.com. It's a little tricky, perhaps, to spell.
I'll stick that in the description.
So it's going to be in the description, carlsteyert.com. And there will be, in the next couple months, there is a newsletter you can sign up for there. So please feel free to do so. And everybody who signed up to that newsletter will receive news when we publicize a series of our next foundational trainings and a year-long training that's coming up next year. So that's coming very soon, and the newsletter is a great way to get more information. Thanks.
Amazing. Thanks, Carl. Thanks, everybody. See you on the next one.